Hello, welcome to Picayune Conversations. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Calvin.
And today, I think we're going to finish, not finish, but add something to our little repertoire of emotions, our little podcast videos on the purposes, the adaptive purposes of emotions.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea of what you want to do today?
Yeah, we're going to talk about anxiety today.
Fun. I was kind of hoping it would be like joy, but okay.
No, we got to stick with the, these are, you know, sex sells, but so does mental illness, you know?
And misery.
Yeah, and misery. So we're just going to stick with the...
we'll do misery next.
Stuff. Yeah.
Okay. And despondence. Oh, yeah. Okay, so what I remember from Paul Rasmussen, anxiety is the battle emotion. Or it's the, what else? He called it the battle emotion.
The vigilance,
yeah. And it's something that I like to describe, like it gives you energy. It like compels you to prepare yourself and to fight a challenge, an upcoming challenge or battle. That's why he calls it the battle emotion.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So if we just think about vigilance for Harry Potter fans, you can just, I can hear Mad-Eye Moody in the background. Constant vigilance. Yeah. That there's this idea that the world is populated with threats. And the thing is that a threat is... okay, it's always kind of a threat, but it's extra bad if we are unprepared for it, right? And this is why, this is, by the way, why people get so activated physiologically when there are jump scares in a movie, right? Or something like that.
That's my least favorite.
We need this like emotional activation of anxiety to have us be prepared for all of the threats that might be out there. Yeah. What battles might we need to fight? It's something, you know, we can think of it that way.
Yeah. And it does. It comes from this like primal part of us where like anxiety has kept us alive. I secretly love telling clients, I'm not taking your anxiety away. Sorry. You need it. It's literally kept us alive for like millions of years.
Yeah.
However, 2,000 years, I don't know, 6 million, I don't know, don't quote me on that, a long time. Like that's how we knew when we got to the edge of a cliff, like, oh shit, this is high, like I feel like I might die, like that's important, you know, like being afraid if there's a snake or a bear, whatever, you get the picture. So like now I'm just like, it comes from a good place. That's one of those ways to like thank yourself, you know, like, oh, you're just trying to protect me, oh, you give a crap about how your life goes and that you want to survive. I also like to use it against clients in that way. I say that with love. Where I'm just like, oh, you care. You care about getting stuff done. And you have, like, the energy to do it. You're, like, ready to fight battles, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They kind of sit up a little bit straighter. But yeah, do you have any examples of anxiety?
Oh, gosh. I mean, so many.
Maybe a personal. I'm just kidding.
No, I mean, we certainly can talk about personal
spiders.
Things. Okay, yeah, spiders would be a great example. Okay, so several years ago, I was legitimately—I may have even mentioned this on the podcast vlog.
What, probably
again, what, how depends on how you consume this, but I was like clinically arachnophobic. I know a lot of people say like, "Oh yeah, I'm arachnophobic." I was like, legitimately, it was messing with my life how afraid of spiders I was, and so. Yeah, it's not just like, okay, certainly it was a kind of thing of like, if I saw a spider across the room, I was like very afraid, very anxious. But it was also this, you know, that I would lie down in a dark room, so I can't see anything. And then what I would do is I would populate the room with lots of spiders with my imagination, right? And so it's, and then, you know, I'm thinking, well, what would I do? What if a spider crawled on my face? You know, and there's that statistic about you know, how many spiders you swallow in your sleep or whatever. And so, oh my gosh, what if a spider crawls my mouth and it's going to lay its eggs and then there's going to be spiders crawling out of my mouth? And, you know, and so you're doing all this, right? It's anxiety. It does require a bit of imagination, right? That's part of what kind of fuels it and gets it going. So, you know, let's say, there were all these, you know, potential battles against all these potential spiders that could potentially be out in my space. They could potentially harm me. And so then I have all this anxiety. I'm calling upon the anxiety to manage this threat. And so, okay, it was really overstated, and I'm very glad that I there's a whole other story about how I self-treated my arachnophobia that we could get into at some point maybe, but I'm very grateful that I don't feel that way anymore. But it's important that we mention this, that that culturally we are very apt to pathologize just things that are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And anxiety is kind of like chief among those, right? That there's this idea of like, oh, well, we're anxious and how can we stop that immediately? Yeah. And this is really, I think this is deeply, deeply misguided, because the world is a place that is full of threats. Now, how serious those threats are, we can overestimate that, okay? But it's not like we live in a world that is free of threat.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem. That's part of the a huge part of the problem is that a lot of these things are real, especially like danger to women, you know, and or queer folk, you know. That's real, and
I'll add this too, that it's also not just physical threats. There are psychological threats, you know. Mm-hmm. Somebody who wants to be, you know, if they live life as if life means be the smartest person in the room. There are psychological, I mean, nobody's going to get beat up for making a stupid comment. Okay. Or that would be very, very rare. Okay. That you would actually get physically harmed, that you would get killed, that you would be, you know, that there's some like apocalyptic physical outcome for you, but it can be experienced as that way. Because there are also these like psychological threats that are out there. And so then you think about, if we add in the psychological threats, the world is so full of things that can potentially hurt you. And so do we need anxiety? We absolutely do. And the pursuit of an anxiety-free life, an anxiety-free world, is first and foremost a pipe dream. That is an unreasonable goal to have. And secondly, the implications of trying to build a world in which we are utterly free from anxiety is, it's inhumane, because what you end up doing, you create such an unbelievably tiny little space for yourself that you're cut off from all the things about life that are marvelous.
Yeah, we need problems and challenges.
Yeah.
That's how we attain cooperation and happiness.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have them. We need to just accept it and do wise things with them.
Yeah.
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 I like that you say that it's this idea of it being imaginary, because that's one of the skills that I teach clients is like, okay, it's imaginary. It's made up. Like, no offense, but it's like, it's made up. If you can imagine the negative side, I want you to just what if in the positive direction. Keep doing the negative stuff. I'm not telling you to change or stop that. Just keep on being negative Nancy. And just add, what if? Okay, like, so what if I'm late to work and my boss is mad and fires me? What if you arrive on time? What if I arrive and nobody sees me? What if I arrive and my boss doesn't care? What if I arrive and my boss is late? You know, like, just add it, right? Because that's also imaginary. It's sort of, in my intimacy classes, I call, like, you know, like, imaginary or, like, fantasy. I call it acting as if with the mind.
Mm,
you know, like, it's a way to play with anxiety. We're naturally, inherently going to fill in. There's always, like, blanks in the future. And because we want certainty, we fill it in. We typically fill it in with whatever we think is going to protect us or have our life go well. Why not put some other crap in there that's a little more positive?
Yeah.
And then you're flirting with anxiety, which is what we do when we play. Like, if you think about playing as a child, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how the game's going to go. You might not even know the kid you're asking to play on the playground, but you do it anyway.
Yeah.
You're playing with anxiety.
Right. Yeah. Now, I think one of the things, I love that we're talking about this, that I think there's this like cultural drive to be like, oh, well, those are anxious thoughts, and anxious thoughts are bad thoughts. We have to get rid of anxious thoughts and only think non-anxious thoughts.
Gaslighting.
This is again, a pipe dream, and secondly, really deeply inhumane. We need to not do that, okay? But I don't know, this is just something that I say, or if you say it too, but we call it subtraction by addition.
You're such a dork. Oh, my God.
You know, because people say, oh, addition by subtraction or whatever. But this is subtraction by addition, okay? Is that it's not that we reduce anxious thinking, but that we bring into view courageous thinking as well. That these two things can sit alongside each other, because we do need, we need both. Now, one of the things you're mentioning, that this is something that you do with clients, often with clients, if clients come in and we're talking about, oh my gosh, I'm feeling so anxious, one of the first things we do is we just slow down and we give a little bit of thought to, what is the threat?
What's the challenge? Yeah.
What is the threat? What's the challenge? What's the battle? We could use a whole bunch of different words. I think I often tend to use threat. of what's the threat that your anxiety is trying to prep you for.
Yeah.
And what's so cool about this, right, is that even in the act of identifying the threat, there is something helpful about that. Okay.
You're getting so, like, curious about yourself.
For instance, let's go back to my arachnophobia. Okay. If somebody's watching me freak out and they're like, you know, watching me have this moment of anxiety or this long moment of anxiety, and they're like, "Hey, so can you just tell me, like, what's the threat here? What's your anxiety trying to get you prepared for?" Well, then I'm gonna be like, "Yeah, I'm. There's this threat of this spider crawling into my mouth and laying its eggs, and then those eggs are gonna hatch, and then there's gonna be a bunch of eggs or spiders that are crawling out of my mouth, and they're gonna bite me everywhere." And it's okay. Now the thing is that as I'm saying this,
you're gonna have nightmares.
I'm like, okay, this is pretty ridiculous, isn't it? Right? And by the way, it doesn't require the other person being like, well, you know, how likely is that? You know, is that logical? Is that rational? Which those might be fine questions to ask. But really, just in the act of me saying this, I'm being confronted with the absurdity of this way of thinking. It's like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen. Like, this is pretty extreme, isn't it? Like, spiders laying eggs inside your mouth, and then somehow they survive the weird environment of my...
I can't talk. I slept with a sleep mask over my mouth and nose because there was a spider on the ceiling in college.
Okay, I mean...
I didn't want it to crawl in my mouth.
Okay, but that's it, right? And then you, like, throw in a little bit. I really have some interest in ethology and animal behavior and things like this. And then it's like you learn a little bit, and it's like... Spiders don't, like, in the best way, they don't care about humans. Yeah. They don't care.
Unless you're, like, trying to hurt them.
Yeah, unless you're fooling around with them. You know, if you're, like, messing with their web,
yeah,
or, you know, their home or their ability to survive, you know, whatever. Like, they don't care. And so it's not like I would get in this way of thinking where it's like, yeah, every spider on the planet is conspiring. They're all conspiring together.
You're so special.
No, I mean, exactly. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's so there's just something fundamentally powerful about even just naming the threat. Like, it's, boy, we're just like on Harry Potter today, but I remember Dumbledore says this thing pretty early on that the naming of something, it like robs power. That everybody, like, nobody will say Voldemort's name, and Dumbledore does. And his case for that is the naming of it reduces the power of it. And that's actually an archetypal idea that shows up in, I was reading this other fantasy book series to my kids last year, and there was this same thing where there's this really, really bad character, kind of like a big villain, and what right at this pivotal moment, this bad guy's about to kill the main character, and then suddenly he just, like, disintegrates. And it's because another character learned that character's name, the actual name, and spoke it, and then poof, right? So this is like that's a very old idea, and so even just that with clients of asking them to name a threat, there's something.
It's like you're asking it, you're telling it exists, allowing it to be there, which it strikes me that people try to, like, control a thing that they're not allowing. You have to allow something, you have to allow the feeling in order to be able to manage it.
Right? Yeah.
Like, I'm not crazy in thinking that. I lost my train of thought.
Well, but you're making a good point here that, like, you know, similar, we just had this interesting conversation about sadness in our last episode about how we kind of need to interact with our sadness rather than trying to ignore it or make it go away. It's the same with anxiety. Sometimes why people are so anxious is because there's a threat out there that they could actually deal with, and they're not dealing with it. And so then it's like, again, it's, I don't love talking about emotions as being external to us, but just metaphorically, it's like our anxiety is waving its hands at us saying, like, listen, like, this is not good. Like, you need to pay attention. You need to be ready. This is not going to go well. This is not going to go well. And then you just leave it, and you're not actually attending to the problem. And then we're like, why am I so anxious all the time? It's like, well, because you're not listening to it.
Yeah, you're disrespecting yourself.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
It's like you treat yourself like you're crazy. Like, there's absolutely no reason for you to be anxious. And there's, people do things for reasons, and that includes feeling.
Yeah. I feel like acceptance and curiosity, it's like two essential first steps with these emotions, with all emotions.
Yeah. So let's talk, okay, Look, for those of you who are listening, if you want to learn how to manage your anxiety through coping skills,
good luck.
Have a nice 15-second Google search or ask ChatGPT to make you a list of 15 coping skills, and that can get done like that. And so I don't think it would be like the best use of our time. But let's say past coping skills. Okay. What is it that people can do if they are feeling anxious? What could they do to be helpful to themselves?
The first thing that came to mind is my favorite coping skill. So I'm going to start with, can I start with that? And then it'll get my brain cranking. Okay. And I'll do it quickly. There's another episode on it. I don't know what it is, but there's another episode on it. But I give a little bit of psychoed, you know, about the purpose of anxiety, all of those things. But I also say, like, anxiety, if this is calm and this is anxiety, like, being in a state of anxiety is a state of arousal. It's what our brain sees it as. You know what else is a state of arousal? Excitement.
Okay.
Our brain reads it almost identically. In, like, an MRI, you see the similar parts lighting up. So, not to, like, I don't say this in a disrespectful way, just in a way that you understand your brain and that you can prime it to think something different. That's how I reframe it. So, you're feeling anxious. Instead of trying to go from 0 or 100 to 60, which is... I know I keep saying disrespectful, but that is, like, not physiologically possible. It's disrespectful to ask yourself. Even if you had, like, 4 Xanax, it's still going to take you a minute to get down. So don't ask your body to do that. Instead, stay here. Get curious about it. Don't say, like, oh, how can I, like, quickly move away from this? Sit in it. That's probably my answer to your question. Sit in the anxiety for a second. And then you find something that you can get excited about. It does help if it's related to the thing that you're anxious about. Like, if I'm anxious to do this or to present, I'm excited that I get to, like, meet new people, or I'm excited that so-and-so is going to be there, or that I'm going to contribute something, even if what I contribute is looking like a fool and somebody else thinks, oh, I can be a fool and share things, you know, whatever. I focus on the contribution and my anxiety just naturally goes down, because you can manage excitement easier than you can manage anxiety.
Okay. Yeah.
Sit in the anxiety and thank yourself for trying to protect you and keep you alive.
Yeah.
Welcome it to the table. That's what I would say.
Oh, that's, yeah. I like that there's this, just a mindful interaction with an emotion rather than this kind of knee jerk, impulse to, like, oh, let's get rid of it.
Like, oh no.
How can I stop feeling this immediately? Right.
Can we get panic?
Well, and then you look and it's like, well, you know what actually is really good at doing that? Are addictive substances. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, certainly you've got your benzodiazepines, but then you've got alcohol, you've got opiates, you've got all kinds of things that are immensely effective in doing this. And so if the goal is to just make the feeling go away, well, we're setting ourselves up for some maladaptive strategies. But if we can just slow down and interact, and so I like this reframe from anxiety to excitement. I also think that there are some weird cultural messages that we have about anxiety, and that is that the ultimate solution to anxiety is safety. Mm. And the problem with that is that, as we've already talked about today, like, the world is not safe. And so that's a project that I do think that there are levels of safety, of relative safety there, like, fantastic. Okay. Like, if I ride a bike, I'm going to wear a helmet. Okay. That's relative safety. That's saying this is a very simple step that I can take that dramatically reduces the likelihood of something really awful happening to me on this bike ride. Okay, great. Wonderful. But, listen, if you want a perfectly safe bike ride, you know what you do? You just don't ride a bike.
You stay home.
Yeah, that is the only option. Like, even if you're out on an abandoned road that somebody has built just for you to ride your bike on, there are just little elements of chaos that are going to get interjected there, and maybe you fall off the bike and scrape yourself and get hurt and break a bone or something like this.
But also, like, you've seen an obstacle course that somebody built and it's too easy.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it because there's no challenge there.
Precisely. Yeah. So I think there's an important reframe here too, which is that, maybe if you are feeling anxious, maybe there is a little bit of relative safety that we need to bump up and increase. Okay. If you're walking around by yourself at night in a not great area of town or something,
and you have a uterus.
Certainly. Okay. Like, let's get a trusted person to be with you. That to me sounds really reasonable and whatever. And I don't think that this, I think I can say this with scientific confidence, this is not the solution to anxiety. ultimately. It can help, but it's not unimportant whether or not there's relative safety. But at the end of it, courage is actually what is helpful. And so sometimes what that looks like is moving toward, in a thoughtful, relatively cautious way, moving toward the thing that frightens you. And now we're back to my arachnophobia. The thing that helped me with my arachnophobia was not finding a way to rid the earth of spiders, which would have, by the way, decimated our planet's ecosystem. We need spiders. There are amazing, amazing creatures that we need to respect and appreciate and love, and which I'm thankful that I've grown in all that. How I cured my arachnophobia was there was a spider that would make a web that made this big web right outside this window at my old house. And every morning I would make my coffee and I would go stand as close as I could to that window. And I mean, and this spider was eye level. Like, I mean, so really just as the crow flies, it was, you know, all of an inch and a half away from my face, this spider. And it was awful. It felt horrid. And after about 3 or 4 days, I was over. And I started noticing some things about the beauty of the web and
got curious,
looking at the spider and appreciating it for what it did and what it was doing. And oh my gosh, look at all these bugs that it's eating. And so now those bugs aren't, you know, biting me on my ankles when I'm out in the lawn. And like, so I think there's this aspect to if we're identify the threat, to think it through and to say, is there a, not thoughtless, not impulsive, but is there a way for me to move toward this? Is there a way for me to move toward this thing that is freaking me out, that is scaring me? Can I take this thing on rather than simply avoiding it? Yeah.
Love it. Way to wrap it up.
Yeah. There's more perhaps that we could say, but let's stick a pin in it for today. I think maybe we'll do at least one more in this series of emotions. We'll offer at least one more. Anguish. I mean, I'm going to have to look that one up in the dictionary or something. But we will find something. Again, hopefully it will be fun and relatively informative, helpful, entertaining. We will see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.